Welcome to The Right Chamber,
the podcast where we dive deep into the fascinating world of medicine and healthcare.
In every episode, we will talk about pivotal topics relating to medicine and surgery in the UK and what it's like to be a healthcare professional today. We are inviting doctors and other healthcare professionals across different specialties to discuss their experiences and give an insight into what their journey has been like. Please follow us on Instagram and TikTok at RGUCMS and subscribe to our YouTube channel, RGUC Media. So sit back, ignore the traffic, and enjoy the Right Chamber podcast. Sabina Jamil Chowdhury is Professor of Medical Professionalism Education at the University of Birmingham Medical School. She is Academic Quality Lead, Senior Personal Academic Tutor, and Equality, Diversity and Inclusion Lead for the School of Medical Sciences. A practicing GP in Birmingham, Sabina holds a doctorate in enacted practical wisdom, was Associate Dean for NHS England, and a founder of both the Practical Wisdom Network and Della Fish Foundation.
Welcome back to the Right Chamber podcast. My name is Jaspreet.
My name is Victor.
And today we have a very special guest with us, Professor Sabina Jamil.
Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
So tell us a little bit about yourself before we dive into the podcast.
Oh, right. Okay. So I'm the daughter of an Indian immigrant that came over in the 1960s. I was born in the 70s. Oh my God, I shouldn't have disclosed that quite so early on. I grew up in the Peak District, close to Manchester. I loved growing up in the countryside. I then went to Nottingham University, where I studied medicine. Obviously qualified as a doctor, did my foundation training initially in Derby, but then met my husband, actually got married and came to Birmingham. There I did GP training and then started working as an inner city GP, which is what I still do now. So I've been doing that for, 25 years. Mm. And I find that really rewarding. But alongside that, in about 2006, I started to dabble with medical education. And what was really interesting about studying medical education was how the theory and the social science came easily and intuitive to me compared to sometimes the hard science that you have to learn when you're in medical school. So this really grabbed me and I thought, yes, and realized that if I want to shape the future of medicine, then actually getting involved in education is a good way to do that. And that brings me sort of to my journey, which was never a massive aspiration that I want a PhD or I want to be a professor. It was never anything like that. It was just, what little steps can I take to help me address what I think was a gap or maybe was not done well in my own medical education? And that was things like the fact that I very strongly felt that the connection part, the humane part, the character aspects of being a good doctor were not emphasized. Mm. And it just felt like drudgery of knowledge. And interestingly, I never could have predicted this now, but with the advent of AI, the knowledge is at our fingertips. And actually there is more of a need for us to be that genuinely caring human being, that doctor. Those are the skills that I think we need to nurture.
Absolutely.
And that's the direction of travel that I've been in. And it's, obviously I've just mentioned, I have a PhD that looked at wisdom in doctors. And I really feel I interviewed, took the life stories of 20 high scoring doctors on a wisdom scale. And I feel there are lessons there that help us learn how to be better in relation to character and professional virtues. And I align that with professionalism. So that's what I'm a professor of medical professionalism education.
Wow. Wow. Amazing.
Can you give us some examples of what you found out from these interviews with the wisdom doctors?
Okay. So actually in my PhD, I obviously have transcripts from the interviews that I did. And then collated those transcripts and used a technique called corpus linguistic frequency analysis to kind of gather what they were really talking about. And I came up with 34 attributes, of which I can't roll off because I can't remember them all, but I will tell you the most important ones. And it was things like being open-minded. It was about being humble. It was about being able to reframe things that were difficult and the focus on growth. They felt they had a strong sense of agency and autonomy, that they could direct the future of their lives. I think a really key thing was they had healthy boundaries, and everybody has to explore their own boundaries that are healthy. And it's different for different people. So there's no one size fits all. And that became clear as well. I think one of the major things that I would say, whether you had a faith or no faith, the golden rule was really important. So that was to do unto others as you would for yourself or your family. And it's these kind of values that underpin the way that they behave in their daily lives as wise doctors. So I try to now embed that in what I deliver in professionalism curriculum. And I guess one of the hardest jobs has been to redefine professionalism, because it's got baggage. Lots of people may conceive professionalism to be to just follow the GMC rules or to just follow the law. And it feels like all these rules are being imposed on you. And it's true, we do have to follow the GMC rules. We do have to abide by the law. But for me, professionalism is so much more than that. It's about exploring who you are, how you're going to navigate this profession with all the values that you have grown up with, that you're learning about how to be a good doctor. And essentially, if I was to get a little bit technical, I studied phronesis, which is practical wisdom, and it's rooted in Aristotelian virtue ethics. And it's about doing the right thing at the right time for the right reason for the right person. And fundamentally, it is a master virtue that adjudicates when values conflict. And we are, in our daily lives and in our clinical practice, we are forever having to navigate conflicts of values. So for example, if I see a patient, they're asking me to examine them for a breast lump, I have a suspicion that this is not good news. I have sort of, do I be kind or do I be brutally honest? How do I navigate that with the person in front of me? And as a GP, I have longitudinal relationships with patients. I may know that this person suffers from chronic anxiety. So I have to find the right way for that person in front of me to convey that news.
There's no one way fits all for every single patient.
Whereas some of the rules-based may say you must be honest at all times.
Yes.
Mm.
But you're thinking, hang on, I know this patient, and if I tell them I think this is cancer, I will torment them for the time, that 2-week wait, for every single day they're waiting for that appointment. So somehow I have to find the language and the right way to do the right thing for the right person.
It's kindness to the patient as well.
Absolutely. And I think one of the biggest things that actually, structurally, if you look at medicine and its education, the moral mode of practice, the moral imperative has almost been removed because we're supposed to be objective and things like that. Whereas bottom line, when we're talking about professionalism, we're talking about values, opinions and feelings. Well, they're not objective. We're dealing with this sort of grey area. And actually, there are better educational frameworks that suit that kind of work, like constructivism. And that's essentially what my plea is to people, to be flexible in realizing that there's different tools for different types of learning. And let's embrace this, because as a result, we can be better doctors.
Absolutely. And that's amazing. And it's not just about focusing on the external rules that are being imposed, that, you know, kind of like a tick box exercise. Okay, do this in this way, then this, then this. But actually, it's a lot of the values and morals, as you've said, that you've been trained with during med school, but then also just before that as well, and just your interaction with people and the nuance that you know is associated in conversation and making sure you're delivering information in the right way that's targeted for that person. So yeah, that's a very interesting take on that aspect of professionalism. Okay, and you are someone who wears many, many hats, isn't it? tell us about some of the positions that you're taking up at the moment.
Okay, so we're designing a new curriculum for the MBCHB program, Curriculum 2030. So I'm professionalism lead of the curriculum content for that. So that's one thing I do. And what I love about that is the opportunity for my research to inform this new radial holistic professionalism curriculum. And that's really exciting and fulfilling when you see that that something you've been working on academically can be converted into real, tangible practice. So that's one thing. I'm also academic quality lead. So some of you may have seen me on the quality visits when I come to your hospitals with the quality team. And then essentially we need to find out what your experience has been like. And it's a sort of mutually beneficial activity in that we want to support the trusts to deliver the best education they can. But also we also need to make sure that they are following the GMC quality education frameworks, and that if there are any gaps, we're hoping it's kind of a supportive opportunity. And quite often in these meetings, I make recommendations to the medical school and I make recommendations to the trust to try and make things better. But also things like your end of placement evaluation feedback into this system so that we know there's certain things that we really do need to address and improve. So that's another thing that I do. The medical school is part of a bigger school called the School of Medical Sciences. And interestingly, the other four units in the School of Medical Sciences are research units. And so in the School of Medical Sciences, I'm EDI lead, so Equity, Diversity and Inclusion lead. And I'm enjoying this work, but of all the work that I do, I can honestly say it's emotionally hard. Because you see people who have been subject to discrimination, harassment, they find it hard to escalate concerns. You sometimes know that there's institutional systemic issues that are not necessarily helping people from with protected characteristics and otherwise. But to be involved in trying to ensure that there is fairness and justice feels like a noble quest, really, as difficult as it can be. And then there's not only do we have the issues that come up from the students, from the staff, there are also diktats from government, there's university policy that we need to try and implement to make things more fair. And interestingly, I don't see the EDI work as separate from professionalism work.
They go hand in hand.
Yeah, so I have a favourite definition of professionalism, and it's got four components. And three of those components have arisen in previous definitions of professionalism. So obviously that's things like commitment to continuous learning, collegiality, working in teams, all those kinds of things have showed up before. But this 2020 definition by Ong, I favour, because one of those elements is a commitment to our equality, diversity and inclusion, irrespective of somebody's gender, race, religion. I do not believe you can be a humane professional if you are harbouring hate or discrimination towards a certain population. So very much embedded in professionalism is that commitment to fairness and justice.
Yeah.
I think you're in the wrong profession if you harbour any sort of hate or discrimination as a doctor.
But you'd be surprised, actually, because the geopolitical climate is difficult. And not only a few weeks ago, I ran a conference on creating dialogue for compassion, basically educating against hatred. Because I'm hearing things now from my different environments. If I'm not seeing that consultant because they're from that background, or I don't want to see that doctor because they are an immigrant doctor. I'm hearing this in society now. So this work is more important than ever.
Mm. Excellent.
Are there any steps being taken to make sure that EDI rules and regulations are implemented in hospitals and institutions?
I suppose when you do these quality visits, do you just make recommendations, or are there active steps that they
have
to...
Are there seminars that are held in hospitals?
Well, I mean, even here, when I walked to your hospital, in the main entrance, it was about how patients were expected to respect staff irrespective of their background. So things like that, raising awareness. I think in my role, it's about holding institutions and people to account on closing the loop that things are being done. But as we said at the very beginning, it's not just about following the rules. You can tick box that you've done your mandatory training on EDI, but that may not actually influence your next interaction with a patient who is from a different background than you, and you're already harbouring some difficulty with that. And I think that that's another thing about professionalism. It's about the introspection that is required in yourself, the reflection that is required to think, well, how could I have done that better? How could I tackle this with a more open heart, with more compassion? And we are all learning, and I'm still on this journey too, of thinking, hang on, every single day, there are opportunities where I could have done things differently with different outcomes. And we mustn't forget that we have a choice. This is going to sound really strange, but I still work as a GP, and some of those days are really hectic. And it's really easy to get mopped up in that I'm feeling stressed, I'm running late by about 4 to 5 minutes. That then puts pressure on the next person to walk into that room, and you're not really 100% giving them attentive listening, because you're thinking, I'm hungry now, I need to go to the toilet now, or I'm late to collect my child. But actually, if you make that intention, I've just got to surrender to the fact I'm late, but this is my opportunity to give the best of my attention to this person who genuinely needs help. And that intention can refocus you to do the best and to listen, because that's a gift as well. If you can listen well, I've had patients, one of the nicest compliments I've had from patients is when I don't feel I've done anything, I've not prescribed anything. And they just walk out of the room and they say, doctor, just talking to you has made me feel better.
Yeah. And it's something you hear quite a lot, even on my short placement in general practice. So being a more junior resident doctor in GP, I had a luxury of extended time with the patients. And often I just found that them just knowing that they've been listened to is a lot of time half the battle already won. And you just giving that listening ear alone is almost like therapy in itself for a lot of patients, isn't it?
Oh, and be it with patients or with your own friends and family, they know when you're distracted. They can tell because you're looking at your phone, you're looking at the screen, you're seeming a bit restless. But if you can literally, at the start of every consultation, Roger Neighbor has consultation models and he calls this housekeeping. If you can get yourself in the right space to make sure that that is a fruitful 10 or 15 minutes, that intention itself can really help you.
And I mean, it can be challenging sometimes with, as you've mentioned, alluded to, the systemic pressures that we're often under. Again, the profession, the healthcare profession is one that's quite under the magnifying lens to society, and every little thing we do can be, it's we feel like we're being watched as well. So there's this thing of, all right, being professional, is it about this image I need to portray? But how much of it is actually internal changes that, regardless of what other people see. This is me and this are my values. How can I be the best me that I can be to this patient in front of me, regardless of who might be watching or what's the guidelines? I just want to be the best I can for this person in front of me. And I think that's...
Because you think about it, your list is running late, right? But this patient still gets the 15 minutes. Just focus on the patient and then move on. At least you're giving your all attention to that patient for the 15 minutes that they have.
And I think, I guess I'm lucky in that I've been at the same practice for about 20 years. So my patients are willing to wait because they know that I'll do my best to listen to them when their turn comes. And I think sometimes it's harder when we're working in systems where there's no longitudinal relationship. It's becoming more of a transaction, a service, a bit like getting your haircut or whatever. If you're not on time, it's different. You think this is a service, I'm paying for it. So that relational aspect of care is really very important. And alluding to what you had said earlier, a really important part of professionalism is not just compassion for patients, it's compassion for yourself. And I think the profession makes us work so hard, it's easy to forget that, you know, you do need to look after yourself. There's this analogy that when you're on a plane and the plane's crashing, you've got to put your own gas mask on first for the oxygen before you give it to anybody else. And learning how to do that can be hard. I know I've come across medical students who don't want to tell the medical school, I don't want to go to student services and well-being, because they think it's a failure to have some feelings that could be depression, or they don't know why they're not feeling right, and they feel it's a failure to even mention it.
Because people think it will be stigmatized, mm-hmm. and that will be on their record that you're not fit to be a doctor. I think that's what really is a problem, where people think, if I go, they're going to think that I'm not fit to be a doctor anymore.
And we need to overcome that, because stigma's huge. I can't deny it's there, and you're absolutely spot on. But even if you look at the GMC on fitness to practice, if you had numerous medical conditions, the goal is to support you back into work if that's possible. And so there's this self-reporting system where if you're ill, you've been in hospital, etc., you can report to the GMC, not to get into trouble, just because of that level of self-awareness that you're putting things in place to try and help get back into work. And I see this, and I sometimes feel, maybe rightly or wrongly, being on a staff member at the medical school, that sometimes there's this feeling that it's us and them, students versus the med school. It's not in that. We genuinely want you to graduate. We want you to become doctors. And if that means taking a leave of absence, if that means taking some time off, then you know what? Maybe that is that point when I refer to the 34 attributes of wise doctors. Sometimes those are the points of most growth, who you really learn who you are, what you want, what has meaning for you, what you feel your purpose might be. It's often those swampy lowlands, as been termed by Donald Schwann. The swampy lowlands are where you learn a lot about yourself.
Mm. Yeah. And this conversation brings me back to one of the professional development group at my medical school, back at the University of Exeter. The facilitator just asked all the students, what is a good doctor? What makes a good doctor? And I just think back to that time. I was maybe second year or so. And at that time, it is just as you said at the beginning of the conversation, it's more about, okay, they're knowledgeable. They know what to do. They've memorized lots of medications and lots of medical conditions, and they can remember things quickly, and it's all about skill and all about knowledge. And then during the course of that conversation, just thinking back now, it's then when the facilitator then broke it down further, that actually, just as we've said, it is so much more than just the most knowledgeable person or just the most knowledgeable. And actually, if you were to ask the patient and ask from their point of view, what makes a good doctor, their answer will probably be drastically different to that of that first or second year medical student. So I think conversations like this is really important, just to remind our students that, you know, it isn't all just about sticking your head in the books, but a lot of it is that humanity, wanting to be the best, as we've said, for the patient. And that I think is an important message to make sure that to make sure we pass across to them.
And remember, we are human as well. And sometimes when you see a patient who has clearly lost hope, who is bereaved, there may be elements of that we felt ourselves. And the art of being a good doctor is to oscillate between the subjective and the objective, remembering you are human and you know what it's like to feel that vulnerable, but also that there is this doctor-patient relationship and they're kind of looking to you for support. And that is, again, a skill, which is why I'm so interested in wisdom, which is the culmination of the cognitive abilities, the reflective abilities, and the character, things like compassion. These things have to come together to help do our job.
Yeah, absolutely. A good doctor is a doctor who knows his own limitation, who knows when to ask for help, and, you know, who isn't afraid to reflect on past mistakes or errors, because, you know, no one is perfect at the end of the day. We're all human. But the important thing is, are we reflective? Do we look back on how we've performed on a regular basis and just making sure today I'm better than I was yesterday? And that is it in the end, isn't it?
Well, yes. I'm not saying we abandon the sort of technical skills, because when it comes to things like surgery, you want your surgeon to be top-notch and to not have
absolutely
high complication rates and have the experience. But I just felt that the pendulum was swinging more towards the technical knowledge. It was just very knowledge heavy, yet we were neglecting a little bit this side. And I think to be a whole professional, this all needs to come together.
I think that should be like part of the curriculum, how to speak to patients and actually feel at human level with them. Because I think sometimes when we teach students, they just think, yes, I need to know A to E, know how to manage them, and that's it.
And actually, if you look at how medical education evolved, it is obviously bioscientific foundations. And to a degree, part of the hidden curriculum that results from that is that we learn about the disease first, not the story of the patient. Whereas the story of the patient is equally as important, because within that story, the patient is relating what's important to them. And if you can connect what is important to them to what you think is going on with your pattern recognition, disease recognition, whatever it is, then you're really becoming patient-centered in your approach.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's quite interesting, because a lot of doctors get frustrated when patients start telling you story about 30 years ago, but that's probably what's important to them. And when you keep listening, you'll find that something in that story relates to the present problem.
Yeah, while they're here.
But a lot of us, we're just like, oh my God, no, not 30 years ago. I want to know now.
And that's because we're very much thinking, I only have 10 minutes to do this. And why are you talking about that? But you're right. That's why I actually very much part of developing practical wisdom is appreciating medical humanities, which is how the art, the theatre, the stories, the music help us understand what it is to be human. And again, these help us to become better doctors by broadening our approach to, hang on, the story. How do we analyse this story? What's important in this story? What's important in this poem? These things can help us.
In between your academic and clinical space, how do you just manage it all? Because every time we have encountered you, you look so effortlessly glam that we just want to know how do you do it all?
I think because the reason we met is because I was doing a keynote talk, actually, and I mentioned imposter syndrome.
Mm.
Okay, so maybe some of the reason why I try to look smart or have a persona that dresses a certain way is because it gives me confidence. Because I didn't know, there's nobody who's done kind of the stuff that I've done before. So there isn't a role model in that respect. But then I think, well, who is eloquent? Who knows how to speak well? How are they presenting themselves? And kind of using that to guide, well, if I'm to be taken seriously, I have to present myself in a certain way. And even my quest to do my PhD, I do actually love studying and I loved doing my PhD, but I knew that I couldn't have conversations about wisdom and character with the medical fraternity if I didn't have the qualifications and the kudos to be able to say it. Well, now I do have those qualifications and I can't really be criticized for you're not an expert on this, because actually I have spent an awful lot of time reading this and I think it's important. And that's another thing, actually. How do you do it all? Well, you don't realize you're doing it all. You're doing it all because you have this strong motivation, this strong sense of purpose that makes you grasp opportunities that help you in the direction of okay, well, how can I have influence? And you take those opportunities. And sometimes it does feel overwhelming, especially when I've just agreed to do things on the weekends as well as my working week. I'm thinking, I've not had a weekend off in ages. So, but then you realize, hang on a minute, this does align with what I'm hoping to achieve as a bigger picture. And that strong sense of purpose just keeps me going, really. And as long as these opportunities arise, you find the energy from somewhere.
It's about that kind of motivation and the urge to just want to have a target in mind and what you want to achieve. And every little thing kind of all works together towards that main aim of what you're aiming to achieve.
And that's not to say I always do what I always want to do, because obviously there's some management stuff like spreadsheets that I don't like, but I know I have to do it because the ultimate goal is it helps things get done. And so, yeah, you have to take the rough with the smooth.
And I picked up a little thing you said at the start about how, you know, your motivation has to go in sort of more into the medical education spaces. You noticed a gap in your own experience as you passed through the system. And then that motivated you that actually I want to do something to filling this gap, or just to do something to create a shift. And I find that so inspiring. I think if everyone did that.
You just need to find your drive and then go for it.
So I'm also a fan of aphorisms, so little sayings. So I think it was Gandhi that said, be the change you want to see in the world.
Mm.
And then there was another one from Cornel West, which relates to the EDI conversation, which is that justice is love in public.
Mm.
And all these things, they're very short, but they quite inspire me. And that if you can't remember all these definitions of professionalism, another short one is that professionalism is a trust-generating promise. So that essentially means that you're going to conduct yourself today in a way that a patient or a colleague or a friend in the future knows that you are that person that they can trust.
Mm. Yeah.
And these things do motivate me.
Well, you should be happy to know that you influence a lot of us.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Oh, in the office.
The office, we're like, oh, Professor Jamil's coming today. Yes.
Oh.
Yes, you do. Brilliant. You do.
Shall I tell you what made my day today?
Oh, yes.
They actually said they dressed even smarter because they knew I was coming today. I'm thinking, wow.
Oh, yes. We had to represent for sure.
Oh, that's fabulous.
Just before we let you go, do you have any particular books or materials that, just based on the discussions we've had, just from anything from the top of your head that you think might be good for any of our listeners to just pick up and read or look into?
So it's really interesting you say that, actually, because my own journey into looking at wisdom was because I was reading stuff like that for pleasure anyway. So to do it in an academic sense was just extending what I was doing for pleasure anyway. And I guess one of the books that really made me think, and I enjoyed it, and it's not difficult to read, is Kitchen Table Wisdom by Rachel Remen. I think she was a pediatrician, then she was a palliative care doctor, and she has a very, very humane approach to the way she talks about patients. So that I loved that book. If you want to learn a little bit more about practical wisdom, it is literally about how it's applied in the professions. So there's a book called Practical Wisdom, The Right Thing, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing by Schwartz and Sharp. Again, that's kind of like airport reading. It was an airport kind of book. But you can see how it's being applied to the legal profession, teaching, medicine. So that's quite an interesting book to read as well. I think there are many things like Being Mortal by Atul Gawande. These kind of things just broaden your horizons. And I think one thing we haven't covered today, which I think is really important, reflect on what the goals of medicine are. Because even that, there is no consensus on that. And actually, industry can send you down one route, which is about treating. Whereas actually, if we look at shamans and ancient healers, it's about healing. And healing and treating are not necessarily the same thing. And then you're put in this system, this treadmill of medical education, where you haven't actually even questioned, what are the goals of medicine? And I often see this when we used to run a compassion essay prize for foundation doctors. And it was that essay that for a lot of, there were foundation doctors, would write about this episode that used to replay, I would say, about the futility of prolonging life in a palliative care situation. And they could see that the patient was, all they wanted to do was go home and spend some time with their family. Yet they were being pumped with more drugs, IVs, more investigations. And this scenario, you will come across it. And then that makes you think, well, what are the goals of medicine? And so I'd urge you, even if you're not in that particular situation or faced with it, ask yourself, what are the goals of medicine? Because I think that's a really important question that can tap into what motivates your next steps.
Definitely something for me to ponder deeper on. Thank you so much for coming on our podcast today. I think we've both had a really good time, and I'm sure our listeners as well have enjoyed our conversation. Thank you for the recommendations as well. I'm sure people will look more into that. And just for a note to our listeners as well, as you've been doing, if you have questions or contributions to kind of our discussion, feel free to interact on any of the social platforms that the podcast will be released on. Thank you once again, Professor Javil. Thank you very
much.
Thank
you. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Till next time.
Remember to stay connected with us on social media. Follow us on Instagram and TikTok at RGUCMS. And subscribe to our YouTube channel, RGUC Media, for more exclusive content and updates. Thanks for tuning in to the Right Chamber podcast. Until next time.